Hi, I'm Rob Spall.
And I'm Britt Garner.
Welcome to Nature Insight.
Speed dating with the future. Welcome to the IPBIS podcast, where we dig deep and range wide to bring you new perspectives on biodiversity science and policy.
In our last episode, Britt, you interviewed Shiva Devkota, who is a fungi specialist or a mushroom scientist from Nepal. It was extraordinary to hear his personal experiences and to hear about his research and his mushroom safaris in the Himalayas that are really helping push the boundaries of what we know about the natural world. We're also very proud of the relationship that IPBIS has developed with Shiva as an IPBIS stakeholder.
Okay, I will say that word, stakeholder. We hear it so often, especially within the IPBIS framework and just general policy science interface. But I think the word stakeholder might be not totally well understood. What does IPBIS mean when it talks about stakeholders? Who are they? Like, what stake are they holding?
When we talk about stakeholders in IPBIS, we're talking about any person or any organization that can benefit from the work that IPBIS does or that can contribute to our work. So it really is a very wide definition. And I think one of the things that makes it so different for IPBIS is that for us, stakeholders aren't just a bolt-on to the organization. They're really a core part of who we are and what it is we do. And because of that, IPBIS has created space specifically for groups and for individuals to benefit from and to contribute to our work. We have two self-organized umbrella organizations. One is the open-ended network of IPBIS stakeholders, also known as ONET, and the other is the International Indigenous Forum on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, or IIFBES.
Even with you mentioning these examples, you know, it's still hard to kind of imagine the specifics when there are just so many and varied ways that stakeholders might work with and support IPBIS. So, you know, I'm looking forward to hearing from one of them today.
Well, you're in luck, Britt, because we're going to hear not from one, but from three IPBIS stakeholders.
What a treat.
We're going to be starting with a former colleague of ours, Flore Lefay-Demichaud. Flore was the stakeholder engagement officer with us at IPBIS for a number of years. And when I spoke to her, she told me about how she learned early in her career of the importance of stakeholder relationships.
Initially, I've been trained in environmental sciences and civil engineering, and I joined the French Ministry for Environment and Spatial Planning about 25 years ago. And I started my career dealing with environmental issues and water quality, first in Normandy region. I was in charge of flood risk prevention and water quality issues. And then I moved to the Languedoc-Roussillon region, that is on the Mediterranean. I was then dealing with quality of coastal waters, marine and lagoon ecosystems. And within these two positions, I had many interactions with local elected officials and stakeholders, such as fishermen, shellfish farmers, local industries, NGOs, scientists. And so I got there really on the ground, the conviction that bringing stakeholders together with policymakers and scientists is the best way to move forward and to achieve changes.
I think that's also exactly what you were doing with us here at IPBIS. I mean, you helped to build our IPBIS stakeholder engagement over a number of years. What was it that for you stands out about the work that you did on this with us?
I may be particularly proud of, you know, in 2019, the adoption of the global assessment. There were final statements at the plenary session on the last day, and I really recall the density and the quality of the silence when the open-ended network gave its final statement with some key messages for the policymakers. And I remember how much there was a feeling of huge satisfaction of getting that global assessment out, and also with a lot of hope of that assessment to be, you know, further useful for many other processes in the future.
I also remember how much effort went into all of that. But in IPBIS particularly, my sense is that there is a real pride amongst our stakeholders for the ability that they have to make a difference and to make a contribution to the work that we're doing, and almost a sense of co-ownership. I don't know if you have that same perspective, but you know, the fact that they were willing to put in these long hours, or the fact that there was so much excitement and respect for what was achieved around the global assessment, it really speaks about a level of co-ownership and pride that it makes the stakeholder community a bit more like family in some ways than just shareholders, perhaps in a company, right?
Right. You're very right. I think the fact that people devote time for an institution, I think it's really because they want to make a difference. And I remember that their way of seeing the stakeholder engagement is really a two-way information or contribution sharing. They want to have their issues and knowledge to be recognized.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, I'm thinking of the two, you know, existing IPES stakeholder networks.
Yes.
IFBS, you know, the International Indigenous Forum for Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. They are very much involved in the IPES work, especially for ILK.
Indigenous and local knowledge.
Yes, right. And on the other hand, ONET, the open-ended network of IPES stakeholders, is very much involved in preparing the stakeholder days, in reaching out to young professionals. It has also a section dedicated to promoting social sciences within IPES work. So all these people who spend time for these networks are really willing to contribute for IPES projects and further to bringing this to the whole biodiversity community.
I wasn't around when IPES was first created more than 10 years ago, but I think it's fair to say that stakeholders were in the DNA of the organization when it was created.
Mm.
One of the things that I think reflects that, the fact that IPES pushes so hard as part of its conceptual framework to include Indigenous and local knowledge and all of the different types of disciplines and as many voices and knowledge systems as possible, I think that's also reflected in its approach to stakeholder engagement.
Exactly. You know, the existence of the Indigenous group network to have this ability to give a real seat and a space for this particular knowledge, it's quite unique in the such intergovernmental platforms.
What is it, do you think, that the stakeholders gain from being involved with IPES?
There are two dimensions. One is maybe some very tangible things, just accessing to a very detailed, if you think the global assessment is about 1,000 pages of a range of very up-to-date references. It's a very useful tool. But also they can get a good network, they can access to experts, they can also get some visibility in their own institutions. So I think these are tangible aspects. And the other aspect is contributing to bottom-up approaches, helping to design robust and fair participation processes. And I know also other people who are, for example, trying to have an impact on policymaking while they are doing research on very descriptive micro phenomena in animals or plants. But then contributing to IPES helped them to have another type of impact.
That's really important. Even if you're one of the world's leading experts in a scientific subject or in a particular field, quite often you don't have direct impact on changing policy or changing decisions or influencing investments or changing approaches. You can inform, but it's often quite difficult to make an impact. One of the things you did when you were leading stakeholder engagement was helping IPES to identify and map its stakeholders. How did IPES go about doing that? And why was that important?
Yes, you recall me about this stakeholder survey.
Yes, exactly, the survey.
That we launched in 2022. It was a very ambitious one with a long process to design it. It has two aspects, in fact. One was to inform people of many aspects of IPES that they may have not encountered. So it was a way of giving some awareness of all the products of IPES that were available, but also all the way to engage with IPES. But at the same time, it was a way to map the people that are interested in IPES and to understand their interests and also the barriers they had to engage with IPES.
It helped us to identify which parts of the world were perhaps most engaging with IPES and perhaps less engaging with IPES geographically, but also to help try and identify what kinds of disciplines were engaging with IPBIS. You know, was it all natural scientists? Were there some social scientists? That identification process was important because it helped find the gaps. When we did that, when we were looking for the gaps, what stands out for you about that finding and what we were able to actually work out from that mapping exercise?
First of all, there was this language constraints with some part of the world, and that led us to being more cautious in trying to find the right way to engage with these people with barriers of language. And especially, I remember that in the Stakeholder Day online in 2021, we had new languages brought in, like Russian, etc., to have more people to be able to join the discussions. I mean, we had the interpretation. So language was one, and capacity and funding resources were also very much pointed at by some respondents. And especially for capacity, I remember so that one aspect was the difficulty to devote time for what you have to do in your own activities and also giving this extra time for IPBIS. And one aspect was some recognition by institutions, especially research institutions, that were important for stakeholders. And I think this improved. It's a continuous process. And it was a way of learning where there were still gaps and how to help people to get better ways and more efficient ways of interacting and giving opportunities to engage with IPBIS.
Definitely. So for IPBIS, every person is potentially an IPBIS stakeholder, and most organizations are potentially IPBIS stakeholders, because for IPBIS, the stakeholders are anybody or any organization that can benefit from our work or contribute to our work. So everybody who's listening to this podcast is potentially an IPBIS stakeholder. What message would you like to leave with each of them about taking the time to engage or to engage more with IPBIS?
I would like maybe to share my belief that change has to be incarnated by people. So we have to put in place an as much as possible conducive environment for such actions to take place. Actions that are at small scales but are making things changed. And I think that one dimension of relying on people is to really bring their knowledge and their grounded experience into decision makers' visions and understandings. And that is exactly what we do. And so I really think it's definitely worth it.
Well, Floor, thank you for all of the years and the effort that you invested for IPBIS stakeholder engagement.
And thank you very much, Rob, for your invitation.
I think it's really powerful how she is making an argument for personal involvement. The more people we're bringing in, we have this rallying cry, and the more diverse those voices are, the better that momentum might be.
And it really gives people an opportunity, I think, to see how effective the change can be that they can bring through an organization like an IPBIS. To a lot of people, an intergovernmental platform sounds very removed from any chances that they might have to either make a contribution or even adapt or change something. And I think the ability to do that as an engaged stakeholder, where you're not just receiving information or taking information and helping promote that information, but you're actively involved in contributing and participating in the processes, it makes a big difference.
I think another thing that stood out for me was, you know, part of being an effective stakeholder is having your voice be heard and valued.
Is it?
We talk so much about values, but also in terms of multiple voices, you know, we try to do that on this podcast to hear from these different perspectives. I'm curious, what kind of perspectives do you also have at the table in the IPBIS tent when we talk about stakeholders?
So one of the things that we've talked about a few times in past seasons of the podcast and a few of the episodes is IPBIS is determined to try and bring in as many knowledge systems and types of evidence and voices of expertise and knowledge as possible. And because of that, stakeholder engagement for IPBIS is about reaching out to widen this tent and open up the stakeholder tent. So one of the really important groupings within IPBIS stakeholders tends to be the viewpoints of Indigenous peoples and local communities. And one of the people who we're going to be talking to today is Joji Carino. She's a senior policy advisor for the Forest Peoples Program, but she also helped to establish IIFBES, the umbrella stakeholder organization for Indigenous voices and Indigenous stakeholders within IIFBES. Joji, one of the things I think a lot of people almost intuitively understand is that Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous wisdom is quite different from the kind of Western natural science that tends to be used by most decision makers, or also in governments. Why do you think it's important for Indigenous peoples and local communities to be part of science policy research and science policy platforms?
Yes, I think we're living today in societies which are more characterized as knowledge societies.
Mm.
We use our knowledge and understanding of the world to solve the problems that we have. And I think it is increasingly understood that there are limitations to Western sciences, and that, in fact, what is required is all the knowledge of all cultures and all societies.
I guess that makes a lot of sense, because if you're a government or a decision maker trying to make the best possible choices, it's best to have as much evidence and as many options from as many different types of knowledge systems as possible, right?
Yes.
Now, Joji, you're part of something called the International Indigenous Forum on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, IIFBES. Can you tell us a bit more about IIFBES?
When we look at Indigenous peoples and local communities, most of us operate locally. There are not very mechanisms and structures that fully operate at national, regional, or global levels. And it was to fill that gap that we actually established a network amongst ourselves, this long name of International Indigenous Forum on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, actually directly grew out of our engagement with the CBD.
The CBD, that's the UN's Convention on Biological Diversity, right?
Yes, that's right. And for decades, directly in its articles, there is the recognition of traditional knowledge, because there the parties have recognized forum. It's called the International Indigenous Forum on Biodiversity. And they actually use this forum to seek advice and to get some guidance. So when we started engaging with IIFBES, we already knew the importance of having a mechanism whereby we could engage with parties.
Could you give us an example of a particular person or a particular type of community that otherwise might not have been involved in something like science policy that has become involved?
Yes. For example, our partners and the communities in northern Thailand, they engage in rotational agriculture. From a science point of view, this is seen as a harmful practice. However, this is actually well established to be sustainable in many areas of the tropical forests where this is managed with sufficient management and fallow systems. And because of this, for example, the land degradation assessment and also the pollination assessment, these issues come under scrutiny by IIFBES. We had a follow-up workshop on pollinators in this community that contributed to the earlier assessment. And contrary to the general trend of sharp decline in pollinators, in these communities, the trend was for increasing bees and pollinators. And the reason for that was because their forests were intact. The government was promoting use of pesticides for cornfields and plantations around their territories, that the birds and bees were actually flocking into these areas that were being managed by the communities. So the knowledge from these communities of how they actually take care of bees, the regeneration of forests under rotational farming, is actually a major contribution to fighting degradation, actually.
I remember one of the member states, just after I joined IIFBES, one of the member state representatives saying to me about the pollination assessment that she particularly found it incredible that some of the knowledge from like a 10th generation beekeeper in an indigenous community was of more relevance and perhaps more useful than some of the knowledge that was coming from tenured professors. So I remember that having a particularly great impact. How do indigenous peoples who contribute to IPBIS benefit from making that contribution? Because clearly the science is benefiting and the member states are benefiting, but how do the people from indigenous communities and local communities benefit from making that contribution?
Yes, again, taking from the experience of one, the pollinators assessment, but more generally, the global assessment that was completed in 2019. Mm-hmm. I think the findings there astounded many scientists. But importantly, these messages were going to the governments who were at the same time negotiating the global biodiversity framework and saying to governments and scientists that, in fact, the forests and lands of indigenous peoples are better conserved than most other areas, and that they're actually islands of diversity amidst barren places, right? This was an eye-opener for many. Putting that on the table actually changed the tone and relationships we had with governments. So if we look at the new strategy, you will see many direct references to indigenous peoples and local communities.
What kind of vision do you have for the future, for indigenous stakeholder engagement with IPBIS going forward?
My vision is one where indigenous peoples and local communities are partners of IPBIS to a much fuller extent. Right now, we are quite constrained by scientific rules and protocols, and this make it hard for other knowledge systems to be fully understood and recognized. I think IPBIS should become a knowledge policy interface, not just a science policy interface.
I love this idea of sort of widening the concept of science policy interface to knowledge policy interface, just because there are so many things that can be involved when we talk about information and ways of knowing.
You and I have talked in the past, Britt, about how definitions of words become so important when we're dealing with so many different types of cultures and knowledge systems. So absolutely, I mean, whether or not you count something as legitimate, credible knowledge and legitimate and credible evidence in a science policy or a knowledge policy platform, it's a really important point to be open about and to be flexible on in terms of what you really take into account in your decisions.
Yeah, and I think it's also super cool to think about directionality. So as Joji was saying, this idea of not only being impacted by these conversations and choices and policy being made, but also impacting it. So having this bidirectional cause and effect chain for these local communities.
It's in some ways the nothing about us without us approach to stakeholder engagement, right? A great example of that. I mean, we talked earlier about the impact that IPBIS had recently on the new global biodiversity framework. Within that, a lot of the very important findings from IPBIS's work flowed from the experience, the knowledge, the evidence of indigenous peoples and local communities. And that was then reflected very directly in the outcomes of the global biodiversity framework.
Right. It was so clear that it's not just hearing a recommendation, that there is active engagement and collaboration, which, you know, I love. And it's so cool to hear a concrete example.
We're going to hear another concrete example in a moment, because the largest grouping of self-organized IPBIS stakeholders, as we mentioned at the top of the program, is the open-ended network, ONET. It's really diverse in the terms of the kinds of experience and the individuals who are members of ONET, and I got to speak to one of them. So a big welcome to Håkon Stokland, who is joining us today as a representative of one of those self-organized IPBIS networks of stakeholders. Håkon, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rob.
Håkon, you're a member of ONET, and you actually are the leader of one of the subgroups in that network of social sciences and humanities experts. Why is it that you engage with IPBIS as a stakeholder?
IPBIS is an assessment body of global importance, and a lot of people, a lot of institutions, politicians listen to what IPBIS has to say, also potentially through the, you know, the policy options that IPBES suggests and so on, there is some potential here to affect the politics. And that's what's really engages me and interests me.
Many people believe that the study of biodiversity really is a matter for the natural sciences. Why do you say it's important for social scientists to be contributing as well?
Nature problems are really societal problems. They're consequences of how we organize our societies, so how we act towards nature. And if we want to tackle biodiversity loss and move towards sustainability and transformative change, we need to understand our societies, our relations to nature. For example, why do we continue unsustainable practices, or why are decisions being made to prioritize petroleum production at the expense of biodiversity?
You've been a social scientist for your entire career. How have you experienced the level of acceptance or engagement of the social sciences with subject matter like biodiversity, for instance, over time?
20 years ago, there was a lack of engagement between the social sciences and biology, biodiversity-related issues, both in research and in, you know, policy arenas. But I think that has improved a lot, and I think it's partly because of IPBES pioneering efforts to include different knowledge sources among the social sciences and humanities.
How much do you need to understand the natural science, for instance, in order to draw conclusions from it as a stakeholder in the social sciences, for instance?
I mean, you don't have to be an expert, but I think it's always good to have some understanding. I've studied biology, mathematics, and chemistry for 3 years, actually.
So you're actually a bridge between the natural sciences and the social sciences, then?
Well, partly. I mean...
The reason I ask the question is because I can imagine that, for instance, for some of the stakeholders who interact with IPBES coming from, for instance, indigenous communities or local communities with no particular formal science background, it can sometimes, I imagine, be a challenge to grapple with some of the evidence and the science that's being presented from other knowledge systems and still find common ground.
Right, right. I remember very well when I first got into IPBES, and I was really excited because I knew that IPBES had been a pioneer in including social sciences and humanities. But I also learned quite quickly that there are also still some issues. And I remember one thing I reacted to was some difficulty in looking at power relations related to sustainable use and how we could deal with this in the assessment. So these were, you know, some of my the first things that spurred my mind to think about how can we make contributions from the social sciences and humanities even more meaningful.
So you started your engagement with IPBES as a fellow on the sustainable use assessment, and have now obviously evolved your engagement with IPBES over time. In the time you've been working with IPBES, have you seen any changes in how stakeholder engagement is carried out, or how it's being operated?
I see there's a lot of effort to make it easier for stakeholders to engage with IPBES, and I also think there's been an increase generally. I can say so for the Social Sciences and Humanities Network that I lead. So we started in 2020, so it's not so long ago, but we're already, I think, almost 150 members.
And when you take a look around the metaphorical stakeholder tent of IPBES, who's missing or underrepresented from that tent that you would like to see engage more with the platform?
We need more of a spectrum from the social sciences and humanities. Some disciplines have been quite dominating in the engagement from the social sciences and humanities. So, for example, economics and anthropology. We really need to get in these other perspectives as well from the social sciences and humanities that haven't really engaged that much in IPBES so far.
Well, Hakon, thank you for everything that you and the Social Sciences and Humanities Network have been doing for IPBES and for IPBES stakeholder engagement. And thanks for joining us on the Nature Insight podcast today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
You know, I love a good challenge, throwing down the gauntlet, saying, let's do this thing. You know, I'm totally a sucker for interdisciplinary work, and I brought together some very strange departments for my interdisciplinary PhD. Literally, musical theater and wildlife biology were at that table. You know, we had a very good time. It's exciting to me to see thinking more widely about it. So it's not just, yeah, we can have economists, or yeah, we can have anthropologists. Like, yeah, where's the historian? Mm-hmm. Where are the fine arts? There's just so much about this that excites me.
When Hakon threw down the gauntlet and issued the challenge, what was great about that is he's also helping us pick that gauntlet up and run with it, because the work that he and others within his network and his subgroup are doing is exactly that. It's trying to help bring new people into the IPBIS stakeholder engagement fold and to try and show them the importance and the value of working with our platform, but also to try and widen the degree to which that information is taken on board in the work that IPBIS has been doing. So I think rather than just sitting outside the tent shouting the challenge in, they've walked into the tent and are helping open the tent up, which is great.
Yeah, it's never good to hear someone say, we should do that, and then leave the room. So
yeah,
I think it's so cool to see sort of the beginning, middle, and end of that process represented here. But within that excitement, I know there are also challenges. Like, this is not easy work to have this sort of widening of perspectives. What are some of the main challenges, do you think, with that?
Definitely one of the ones that's been talked about quite a bit is language accessibility. And this is something we're critically aware of. I mean, IPBIS as a platform has English as its official language, and we have significant resource constraints in terms of how much is available to do translation and to do interpretation. I think it's something we're very aware of, and it's something that is definitely a barrier to greater, wider, deeper stakeholder engagement. And it is something I think we're working on. Another challenge that exists out there is really the challenge of awareness building and trying to help people see the value in the work that IPBIS is doing and recognize how that might resonate with priorities for them or their communities or their organizations, and then take that next step of actually being engaged and becoming an active stakeholder in the work that we do.
Yeah, I definitely think with these perspectives, it's an easy yes for me in terms of joining, and I hope other people do as well.
So with that easy yes, that's it for this episode of Nature Insight, Speed Dating with the Future. I'm Rob Spall.
And I'm Britt Garner. Thank you again for joining us in this episode. In our next episode, I'm going to be talking to two very special people who went to Antarctica, not an area known for biodiversity, so to say, but went there to push the limits, both personally and academically, and to learn what this solitude of such an extreme place can tell us as a species and also as individuals.
In the meantime, you can learn more about IPBIS's work on www.ipbis.net or on any of our social media channels. Just search the web for @IPBIS. That's @IPBES. Thanks for listening.